All right, well, good evening. My name is Rob Bowman, and I'm pleased to spend this time with you to discuss Christian apologetics methods. We're going to be following more or less along the lines of a book that I put together with a friend of mine, Ken Boa, called Faith Has Its Reasons. And I hope that you'll have an opportunity to read through that book because it'll go into a lot more detail on some things, obviously, than we'll be able to do in our class sessions. On the other hand, if you're reading it and you come up with a question or a comment or an observation regarding something that's in the book, we can go into perhaps into more detail on certain points or further into detail than what is in the book. So that might be worth your time to go through that book. What we do in that book is we survey major approaches to Christian apologetics, categorize them into different categories or types, and take a look at how they differ as well as how they're similar to one another, and what some of the strengths and at least potential weaknesses of them are, so that we can learn as much as we can from all of the different methods and learn how we can have a richer, more robust, and more faithful and cogent defense of the Christian faith. Now, this course is really part two, in a sense, of a two-part sequence, because we did a course on basic Christian apologetics already, and I'm not going to be repeating most of what we talked about in that course, although there is obviously some overlap, but we're going to be focusing very directly on the issue of why there are different kinds of apologetics, why there are different approaches to apologetics, what some of the arguments or issues are pertaining to these different approaches, and hopefully we will again all be learning something that we'll actually use in sharing our faith with people who do not yet know Christ. I think sometimes that focus gets lost in discussions about apologetic methodology. I hope that we won't lose that focus here. But there are times when we will be going into various topics that may seem a little bit involved or a little bit arcane compared to the simple presentation of the gospel. But in fact, apologetics takes into account and recognizes that Christianity, although it proclaims in its essence a simple message, does not deal in merely simple things, but it deals in a coming to an understanding, a knowledge of the Creator of the universe, of His relationship with the universe, and of how we have found ourselves in the mess that we're in as a human race, and what God is doing, has done, is doing, and will do to fix that mess, and why we believe those things are true. Well, those are profound issues, and so sometimes there are questions that come up that are not simple in the way that we answer them, or perhaps some of the simplest answers are not necessarily always the best. And people naturally are inquisitive and ask a lot of questions. How do you know this is true? And if you give a reason, they may come back and say, well, how do you know that reason really holds up in light of this or that? And so, you know, I'm not going to apologize, if I can use that term here, for the fact that Christian apologetics delves into some rather deep waters. That's the nature of the reality that we're dealing with, and that is we're dealing with some of the most profound and deep realities that there are. And so naturally, when we get into that in a big way, we will encounter some of these difficult questions. Now, there is a syllabus that I believe many of you have a copy of, and that will be helpful to you as a way of charting where we are going and where we have been as we go along. And we will be focusing tonight on a basic understanding of what is apologetics from the standpoint of apologetic methods, and we'll be looking at some basic background on the development of apologetics that leads up to the modern discussion about apologetic method. The debate about apologetic method or apologetic theory is really a modern debate, It's not something that's debated very much prior to the modern era, and it becomes a real serious and highly controversial question only in the 20th century. So we will be looking at all that and getting an idea for how we came to that point. I think a lot of people who read certain books on apologetics and notice that there's some kind of a controversy between evidentialists and presuppositionalists or whatever it is, they may feel like they're coming into the middle of an argument that's been going on for some time and they don't understand why there is this argument. And so what I'm going to try to do is to provide some historical context that'll really start this evening. More will be given as we go along, and so you'll not only understand what the different viewpoints are, you'll have some idea of how we came to this point of having these different viewpoints within evangelicalism. And we're only going to be focusing here on issues pertaining to the development of the current apologetic scene in conservative evangelicalism. You will find us referring to Catholics and other thinkers who are not conservative evangelicals, but only insofar as it is really important to be aware of these other figures to understand the current scene, the contemporary situation, and how we came about, how it came about that we have these different approaches to apologetics, and what we can learn from that history. So that's where we're going here. And so I'm going to start here. And by the way, if you've got questions, feel free to raise those. I'll try to reserve some significant time toward the end of our session specifically for your questions. So be prepared for those. And but if something comes up, you want to type a question or something as I'm talking, feel free to do that as well. We'll see how that goes. First of all, we should notice that there are various words that are very similar sounding and overlapping and sometimes in the way they're used, and we want to distinguish somewhat clearly what these different words mean. One of those words, of course, is apologetics. Now, it turns out the word apologetics has several different uses, but we will be focusing on the idea of apologetics as a discipline or a practice in which one is going about seeking to present a cogent argument for the truth of Christianity, from whatever perspective that might be. And it turns out there are a variety of ways of doing that. So apologetics is the discipline or the practice, the actual activity of putting together some kind of a response to questions. How do you know that this is true? And actually, apologetics can be used in contexts other than Christianity. We could talk about Muslim apologetics. We could talk about Jewish apologetics. We could talk about Marxist apologetics, for that matter, although there isn't much of that these days. So the term apologetics could be used in other contexts in Christianity, but of course we're going to be focusing on Christian apologetics, and specifically apologetics defending a conservative evangelical understanding of Christianity. Now, the term apologetic, with no S on the end, can be used as an adjective to refer to something that has to do with apologetics, but it can also refer to a particular argument or a particular system of argument that has been put together to defend Christianity in a particular way. And so you will find people talking about Van Til's apologetic, or Augustine's apologetic, or John Calvin's apologetic. And what they mean is their particular approach or their particular system for defending Christianity, if they have a systematic approach to it, or if they just have a collection of arguments that they use, it wouldn't matter. It would still be their way of defending Christianity, and that would be called their apologetic. Now, an apology, and in this context, does not have to do with saying you're sorry. An apology is a specific exercise in apologetics that would take the form of a speech, could take the form of a book or an article, some self-contained presentation could be a YouTube video. but it's a self-contained presentation defending the truth of Christianity in some context. That would be called an apology. Now, the term apologetics actually comes from the Greek word apologia, which is most famously in ancient literature the title of one of Plato's books. Plato wrote several books that were dialogues between Socrates, his teacher, who had committed suicide rather than give in to the state, give in to the Athenian rules. And in his book, The Apology, or Apologia, Plato presents Socrates giving a defense for why he is not going to go along with the city of Athens, why he's not going to capitulate to their demands, and why he continues to teach what he teaches and is willing to die for it. So that is his apology. Well, obviously, you could see why Christians, and they began doing this in the second century, began writing books called apologies that were defenses of the Christian teaching and their willingness to die for their faith, for their message about Jesus Christ. The most famous author who wrote books with this title, Apology, was Justin Martyr. Martyr meaning witness originally, but later by his time coming to mean somebody who was sealing their witness to Christ by dying and in persecution. So Justin Martyr wrote two books that were called an apology, and the title obviously harkens back to Socrates and Plato's dialogue about Socrates. So that's a very important point, not just from an interesting linguistic study of the origin of the term apologetics and apology, but to understand that to some extent the very exercise, the very practice of creating documents or books or essays defending Christianity with this kind of methodology of argument, of reasoning with people as to why this is true and why we should hold on to this belief, that this has some kind of resonance in the Hellenistic culture with Greek philosophy, with Platonism in particular. And so naturally, Christians were attempting to show that Christianity was a reasonable faith that stood up to the challenges, the intellectual, philosophical challenges that came against it from skeptical intellectuals, whether they were Platonists or Stoics or Epicureans or something else, and the Platonic model of presenting an argument in defense of the Christian faith along the lines of what you see in Plato's dialogue, The Apology, has some influence there, and you can see that in the very origins of the practice of what we call apologetics. Now, that having been said, apologetics could be argued is earlier than Justin Martyr and the second century apologists, and you could also argue that it's much, much younger, it's much more recent, and let me explain why I say that. First of all, apologetics in the sense of giving reasons why the faith is true is something that we find in the Bible itself. It's in the Old Testament and it's in the New Testament. A good example in the Old Testament would be in the book of Isaiah, in which Isaiah ridicules the idols worshipped by the heathen, the pagans in his day. They have feet, but they can't walk and that kind of thing. They have mouths and they can't talk. This is in the Psalms also. And they're made out of wood and stone, but they can't even stand on their own. They have to be propped up. And, you know, it's silly. How can you worship something like that? It's ridiculous. And on the other hand, Isaiah argues that the God of Israel is clearly the true God, because he not only does not have these deficiencies. He is able to call the future into being. He's able to predict what's going to happen and then make it happen. He's the Lord of history. He's the Lord of the cosmos. And so you see apologetics in the Old Testament. You also see apologetics in the New Testament. Really, most of the New Testament could be argued to be works of apologetics in one form or another, or at least touching on apologetic issues. It has become increasingly clear to many biblical scholars, for example, that the books of Luke and Acts, especially Acts, but I think arguably Luke as well, fall into the category of a kind of apologetic. They are an intellectual defense of Christianity, showing that it is historically true, that it is has the backing of antiquity in the Old Testament prophets, and that it was a law-abiding faith that Rome need not fear, at least not in terms of it being an illegal or superstitious religion. And so you see various apologetic motifs running throughout the Gospel of Luke and the Book of Acts, especially Acts, that make it clear that the author, Luke, had an apologetic interest. And most famously, within the Book of Acts, within this apologetic called Acts, there is an apology within the apology. The famous apologetic of Paul in Athens in Acts 17, in which Paul presents a speech in defense of the theistic view of Christianity. In Acts 17, verses 22 to 31, he gives a speech that is in form, that is in structure, the way it's laid out, very similar to the traditional Stoic philosophical oration that a Stoic philosopher would give in defense of his position. And so the content of it is biblical, without actually quoting any biblical verses. But the form, the manner of presentation, the form of reasoning is Greek. It's philosophical. It's even, in some ways, resonating with Stoicism, which was a very popular, more so than Platonism at the time, very popular philosophy in Athens in the middle of the first century when Paul visited Athens. So you have an apologetic within, or an apology within the apology of the Book of Acts. And one thing that you'll find when you turn to the modern argument over apologetic method is that evangelical scholars, evangelical apologists, have different ways of understanding Acts 17. Some of them read Paul's speech in Athens as a discourse in which Paul seeks to establish the existence of a creator God on the basis of reason alone, and on that foundation the revelation of God in Christ can be introduced on the foundation of that philosophical theism. You'll find other apologists who will argue that Paul is doing nothing of the sort, that Paul is in fact rebuking Greek philosophy, rebuking Greek theism, arguing that the Greeks haven't got a clue as to what God is like or what God is and what God wants, and that we are entirely dependent on revelation to know anything about God at all. Then you will find some people, some evangelicals, still, it's not as popular a view as it used to be, but still you will find some evangelicals who will argue that, in fact, Paul did give a very philosophical defense of Christianity in Athens in Acts 17, but that Paul later realized it was a big mistake, that in fact philosophy was not a good approach to defending Christianity or to commending Christianity to people's minds, and he abandoned the philosophical apologetic that he had given for a more straightforward, simple appeal to believe the gospel. And very often Acts 17 is cross-referenced with 1 Corinthians 2, where Paul says, when I came to you, that is, when I left Athens and came to you in Corinth, I determined to know nothing but Christ and Him crucified. In other words, I decided to leave all that philosophical stuff behind and I decided I wasn't going to do that anymore, and I was just going to preach Jesus. Well, I don't think that's a correct reading of Acts 17 or 1 Corinthians 2, but you can see there's a lot to debate here, and I'm only raising the questions to show that the debate over apologetic method and apologetic theory appeals in part to different readings of the same passages of the Bible. Another passage of the Bible that is crucial in this connection is Romans chapter 1. Romans chapter 1, especially verses 18 to 25. Now, in Romans 1, Paul asserts that the things of God, that the nature of God, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature are clearly seen from the things that he has made, so that people are without excuse for their suppressing the truth about God in their hearts and turning to idols instead. And the significance of this passage for apologetics is probably obvious, but exactly what it means with regard to apologetics, what kinds of apologetic strategies it would encourage us to use, that's a matter of significant controversy as well. But what is clear to most people in Romans 1 is that Paul is asserting that there's some kind of way in which God makes himself known or makes knowledge of him available to people in general through creation, through nature, but that in fact the general response of human beings to that general revelation, as it's often called now, is one of unbelief. And if that's the case, if our response to general revelation is generally one of unbelief, then what good are arguments, some people ask, that appeal to general revelation to try to prove that God exists? They would say that there is no value in such arguments. And so you, again, see different people coming away with different conclusions from the same passage. Some people read Romans 1 as an encouragement to construct such reasons, such arguments. Others read Romans 1 as a discouragement against those kinds of arguments. Now, there are other passages in the Bible that have to do with apologetics. Many things that we could talk about. I should probably at least briefly mention 1 Peter 3:15, where the Apostle Peter tells his readers that they should set apart Christ as Lord in their hearts and always be ready to be prepared to give an answer, a reason for the hope that is within them. The term reason here is logos, it's actually a defense is the word used, and it's before that an answer. Some people translate a defense. And that is the word apologia. And so there's apologetics, if you will. Not necessarily in the technical sense, but in the informal sense of being prepared to give a defense to everyone who asks, a reason for the hope, a logos, a rational explanation for why we have put our hope in Jesus Christ. And so 1 Peter 3:15 offers a kind of biblical mandate for apologetics, and that every Christian should be equipped and trained to some extent, at least, in apologetics, because it encourages us to be ready to give an answer, to give a defense, and unfortunately many of us simply are not ready to do that. But it's one thing to say that we need to be ready, it's another thing to know just how we ought to go about doing that. That will, of course, be the focus of this particular course. Now, what I'd like to do next is to begin to move into church history. I've already touched on Justin Martyr and the other writers of the second century known as apologists, but I'm going to jump forward to somebody who could arguably be called the last of those apologists, the greatest of all the church fathers, and that is Augustine of Hippo. Now, by the way, some people say Augustine, and as a friend of mine likes to put it, Augustine is the church father. St. Augustine is the church father. St. Augustine is the city in Florida. So I don't know if that helps you or not, but that's going to be a running debate. But Augustine was a man who converted to Christianity and became a bishop in the Christian church toward the very end of the 4th century, the late 300s. and served as a bishop for over 30 years and wrote numerous books that greatly influenced Christian theology, Christian teaching, and Christian apologetics from that time on. His influence is still being felt, even by people who've never heard of him, never read him, never thought about him. Augustine, his conversion story, his pilgrimage is instructive, and it's not too unlike that of Justin Martyr, by the way. I won't go into Justin's, but it's a similar story. Augustine grew up in a culture that was rapidly feeling the impact of Christianity, but that was still a minority religion. There were a variety of religious beliefs, religious options in his society, and he tried several of them before he got around to Christianity, and probably in part simply because he wanted to find out for himself. He was an independent thinking person, and perhaps a bit stubborn. His mother was a very devout Christian woman, prayed for him for years before he finally came to faith in Christ. And of course, in one sense, spiritually, we would certainly credit her prayers and God's answer to those prayers for his conversion. But Augustine went through a process. And when he got serious, and he wasn't serious as a very young man about anything, about any religion or philosophy, but when he got serious about trying to figure out what it was he was going to believe, he tried two different belief systems before he finally landed in Christianity. And it's interesting to know why he went through this process. The first of these was Manichaeanism. The Manichaeists were dualists. Dualism offers a very simple, or at least seemingly simple, answer to the problem of evil, which is the problem, the philosophical or intellectual problem that really bothered Augustine the most. The Manichaeist answer was, there is a dark power and there is a light power. There is good and there is evil, and they are in eternal conflict, eternal struggle, and we should fight for the side of the good, but ultimately neither one of these is preeminent or primary, but they are balancing forces. Very similar to Taoism in the East, which has a similar dualist philosophy of the yin-yang. Manichaeism seemed to offer a simple answer to the problem of evil. All the bad things that happen are a result of the dark side of the Force, as they put it in Star Wars. It's all the bad things that happen are due to the dark balancing force or power of the cosmos, to the evil side of things, and all the good things that happen are, of course, due to the good God or the good power or the good force, and so you can't blame God or the good deity or the good force. You can't blame it for the bad things that happen because they come from another source. Now, that's a seemingly simple solution, but it turns out it has some very serious philosophical problems, one, not the least of which is, how did we get into the situation that we've got a dark side and a light side, and why should we favor the light side if the dark side is just as real and just as preeminent, just as ultimate as the good side? Why should we favor one over the other? And ironically, it was not Christianity that solved this problem for Augustine, or at least helped him out of Manichaeism. It was Platonism. Platonism helped him to see that Manichaeism didn't work philosophically, and that it helped him realize that it was possible to maintain that the ultimate or absolute reality was all good and still have an explanation for evil. Now, most of us today would probably not follow Augustine's explanation, at least not entirely, but it really helped him, and it helped a lot of people since then, and even people that would differ with him in some ways philosophically would say, he's on to something here. what he got out of Platonism was that evil was not actually real. That is, and to understand what he means by real, we have to think in Platonic terms, not in our modern scientific empirical sense of real. Because in that sense, of course, evil is quite real, and Augustine would have been the first to say so. But in Platonism, the real is the ideal. The real is the absolute, the unchanging, the perfect, the good. And God is, to whatever extent Platonism acknowledged God, God is all good, God is absolute, God is true, God is perfect, and God is real. And everything else is not quite so real as God is. And so Augustine picked up a clue here that he carried with him into Christianity, although he adapted it for the Christian worldview, which is that evil is really not a real thing. There isn't some thing out there, some force or some power that we would call evil. Evil is not a stuff. It's not a substance. Now, of course, evil is real in the sense that evil things happen, people do bad things. Augustine's not denying that. So this is not, nor is this the Eastern mystical pantheistic concept that evil is only an illusion. Augustine did not believe that evil was an illusion. That is a Eastern conception. It is not a Platonic conception, and it is not certainly an Augustinian conception. Augustine's thought was that evil is not real in the sense that it's not a real stuff. It's not a real thing or substance or being. Now, there are evil beings. The devil is an evil being, but evil is not a substance. It's not a thing. And so so where did it come from? Well, it according to Augustine, it is an absence of good. It is a deformation or a corruption of the good, in which a kind of nothingness, there's a kind of voiding of good in what otherwise would be a good creature. So you've got a good person. Created by God as a good person, but he misuses his powers and does bad things. Well, Augustine would analyze that as there wasn't some evil stuff that made him do those bad things, but there was an absence of positive goodness in his actions that had the bad results that it had. Now, I don't know if that completely, if that's completely clear, but the point is that to understand the history of apologetics, this is a crucial turning point, because what Augustine does is he brings this Platonizing kind of way of thinking about reality and good and evil and truth and substance, and he brings it all with him into Christianity. And he says, we can use this, we can apply this and say that evil is not the ultimate reality or an ultimate reality alongside God, but evil is a privation, that's the technical term, an absence, a devoiding of goodness in what God created originally good. Now, this is a very rational kind of philosophical, very abstract way of explaining the problem of evil. Well, the reason why that kind of argument is being constructed here by Augustine is that's the way the problem was posed. It was a philosophical conundrum. It was a philosophical puzzle. How could an all-good, all-powerful, all-loving, all-knowing, all-wise God coexist with evil and much less allow it to come in on his watch, as it were? And so Augustine's looking at this as a philosophical, abstract question that has to be resolved if belief in God is to be credible for him. And so he addresses it in that context. And it's very important to understand in the history of apologetics that certain kinds of arguments are formulated in response to certain kinds of objections. If you ask a rational, logical, deductive kind of question, you're going to get a logical, deductive kind of answer. And so many people find these kinds of deductive reasonings cold, and they don't like them. Well, that's fine for you, but if you're a if you're somebody who's wrestling with a deductive objection to Christianity, a deductive response is what you want. And that's what Augustine wanted. That's what he came up with. And Platonism helped him to do that. Now, after having gotten into Platonism, Augustine eventually found his way to Christianity. And what he came to understand was there were certain things that Christianity had that Platonism simply just didn't have anything to offer in comparison to that, the chief of which was the incarnation of God in Jesus of Nazareth. That was something that Platonism not only didn't have, it didn't predict it, it was totally surprised by it, it didn't fit into Platonism's paradigm of the way things were or the way things could be, and so that rocked Augustine's world, but he came to accept that that was the case, and believe that that God had revealed himself definitively in Jesus Christ, and that that revelation comes to us in Scripture through the testimony or the witness of the church. So Augustine is a major Christian apologist in the history of Christianity, probably the most important apologetic thinker between the Apostle Paul and the next guy I'm going to talk to about briefly, who is Anselm of Canterbury. You got a 1,000-year period there. Augustine is head and shoulders over everybody else, really, in the history of apologetics. And his magnum opus, appropriate using a Latin term for that, his magnum opus or major work was a book called The City of God, which is a very long book. It's actually a series of books in which he lays out in a very comprehensive fashion a Christian philosophy of history, a Christian worldview and a view of creation, a view of history, a view of redemption, a view of the future. It's a comprehensive panoramic defense of Christianity, and at least until recently, when people stopped really paying attention to this, there's really little doubt that The City of God is one of the 10 most influential written works in human history. I don't think that would be an overstatement. If we count the Bible as one, of course, The City of God would be up there in one of the top 10 influential books of all time, in way of changing civilization or being part of a development in which civilization begins to look at things differently. Because of something that somebody wrote. Now I'm going to jump forward hundreds of years to the 11th century to a fellow named Anselm. Anselm was a Christian theologian who was famous for two things in particular that I just want to mention briefly. We're going to talk about these more, especially one of these more in future discussions here. But he developed an argument for the existence of God that is the most controversial argument I think that's ever been formulated, and it has retained significant interest among philosophers, whether they're Christians or not, for almost 1,000 years. And this argument is known as the ontological argument. And I'm writing that out for you here. The ontological argument. The word ontological, the root of this is the word for ontology or being. And the idea of ontology is what is being and what can we know about it? That's what the study of ontology is. Well, the ontological argument is a particular argument for God's existence that Anselm formulated. And it was very creative, and there's really nothing like it before him. people have been debating it ever since. There's various ways of stating the argument. In fact, Anselm stated it various ways, but I'll just give you a quick and dirty description of the argument so you'll know what we're talking about. Basically, the ontological argument says something like this. God, by definition, is the greatest conceivable being. He is the being, and that there's no greater being you could ever conceive of or think about than God. If you can think of something greater than God, it wasn't God you were thinking of before. Because God is the greatest possible and greatest conceivable being. Now, by definition. Now, Anselm's second point or premise is this. Existence is a necessary property of the greatest possible being. Obviously, if you have two conceivable beings, one of which exists and one of which doesn't, the one that exists is better than the one that doesn't exist. So the greatest conceivable being, by definition, would have to exist. It would have to, that would have to be a necessary property of this greatest conceivable being. And so Anselm concludes, therefore, the greatest conceivable being, that is God, must necessarily exist. Now, people have suspected and people have argued strenuously for centuries that there's something wrong with this argument. Some people like it, some people love it, some people hate it. Most people hate it. It should be noted, I hasten to say this, because people will often do not pay any attention to what Anselm actually wrote, that Anselm was not trying to convince himself that God existed. Nor was he trying to convince anybody else that God existed. He was not arguing with atheists. This was not something he developed to help atheists believe in God. The problem of atheism as a serious philosophical movement in society doesn't come around for another several hundred years. Really, what Anselm is doing is he's trying to answer the question, well, if you had to present an argument that didn't appeal to revelation, that didn't have to appeal to the Bible, what would it look like? And his answer is, well, it might look something like this. But of course, I'm presenting this argument as somebody who already believes. So it's important to put that in context. People have debated the merits and the utility of Anselm's argument almost since the day he wrote it. But what's fascinating about this argument, it's an attempt to show at least the inner logic of affirming that God exists without having to appeal to anything in the external world at all. Not only not having to appeal to the Bible, not having to appeal to any specific experience or any specific event, anything that happened in history, anything that might be in your heart or your feelings. No, it's just once you think about it, gee, I guess God must exist. and there are people who have argued that Anselm's very close to being right, but there's one little piece missing. And so there's all kinds of ways of analyzing Anselm's argument. You could see why this kind of argument really appealed to those who are looking for a rational deductive proof that doesn't depend on sense experience, that doesn't depend on any empirical, factual conglomeration of evidence, but a simple, rational, absolute proof. If the argument's sound, then it would be such a proof. Again, most people hate it and think it doesn't work. So I just introduced that to again, give you a sense of the flavor of some of the different arguments that have been bandied about and continue to be argued about in apologetics. I move forward a couple of centuries to a very different fellow named Thomas Aquinas. Thomas Aquinas lived in the 13th century. And in 13th century Europe, the intellectual world was being rocked and turned topsy-turvy by an ancient Greek fellow named Aristotle. Now, I mentioned Plato and his influence on Augustine. Aristotle was Plato's pupil, Plato's student. And Aristotle was a very different kind of thinker than Plato. Plato dealt in abstractions. He dealt in philosophical abstractions and deductive arguments much more what we would consider philosophical. Aristotle is, for most modern minds, much more down to earth. He's much more physically grounded, much more empirically grounded, interested in collecting facts about biology and about the physical world and coming up with some kind of explanation for why things happen in the physical world the way that they happen. Aristotle's philosophy did not appeal to the Greco-Roman culture nearly as much as Plato or as the Stoics. So that in the ancient world, from the time of Plato and Aristotle a few hundred years before Jesus to the time of Augustine and even beyond Augustine in the 4th, 5th, 6th centuries and so forth in A.D., during that 1,000-year period, Aristotle has some influence, yes, but does not come to dominate Christian philosophy and Christian apologetics the way that Aristotle did. Well, along come the Muslim intellectuals, Islamic philosophers, Islamic scientists discovered Aristotle, and they translated Aristotle into Arabic. And people got a hold of it and translated it into Latin, and then, of course, it hit Europe. And so, ironically, even though Aristotle was a Greek and was part of the European culture of his day, medieval Europe discovered Aristotle through the mediation of Islamic Arabic scholars. And these Islamic scholars thought that they had found in Aristotle philosophical grist for the mill of defending the Islamic understanding of God over against the Christian conception of God. They thought that they had found a philosophical foundation for Islam that would vindicate it against Christianity. Western European intellectuals did not know what to do with Aristotle. They saw him as a pagan, which he was, you know, at least as much as Plato, if not more so. They were both pagans. I mean, they weren't Jews or Christians. They were pagans. But they saw Aristotle as more inimical to Christian faith. They saw him as, of course, inimical to their Platonic Christian traditions. And there were some Platonic elements in Christianity, although they weren't heretical. They were simply philosophical ways of explaining things. And some saw Aristotle as a threat. There were people that banned the teaching of Aristotle in the schools, in the universities, because they saw Aristotle as a threat. There were others who saw Aristotle as a challenge to be answered, and particularly the Islamic use of Aristotle. One of these was Albert the Great, and Albert the Great's greatest student was Thomas Aquinas. Thomas Aquinas followed his teacher Albert the Great in saying, we shouldn't be afraid of Aristotle. We can find some good things in Aristotle, we can refute what's wrong in Aristotle, and we can use the logic, the critical tools, the critical thinking skills that we apparatus and tools that we can find in Aristotle to vindicate Christian theism, to vindicate Christianity over against Islam. So it's important to, again, to understand the context of Thomas Aquinas was not answering atheists. It was answering Muslims. Now, why am I emphasizing this? Because what people debate with regard to Aquinas' philosophy and his apologetic constantly are whether his so-called five ways, his five arguments for God's existence, are effective answers to atheism. Well, they were never meant to be. That wasn't what Thomas Aquinas was trying to do. He was developing a Christian philosophy, including a Christian understanding of the logical foundations of belief in the God of the Bible, in the God of Christianity, that would be effective as a retort to a refutation in response to Islamic philosophy. He wasn't trying to answer atheists. So now you've probably heard some of these five arguments, but the five ways are basically empirical ways of arguing that God exists from, for example, the fact of contingency. Everything that we see in the world is contingent. That is, its existence is dependent on something else. It didn't have to exist. You didn't have to be born. You were born because your parents happened to fall in love, get married, and have, you know, hopefully get married and have you. If they hadn't done that, you wouldn't be here. And your parents likewise are contingent, and so forth and so on, and we can go back as far as you like. Everything that we know in the physical world is contingent on something else. Well, Aquinas, using some Aristotelian forms of reasoning, argued that you can't have an infinite regress of contingent causality, of contingent relations. At some point, you've got to come back to something that is necessary to exist, that has to exist, that could not not exist. And he says that's what we call God. That God is a necessary being. Now you can see there's some connections here with Anselm's argument about God being a necessary being, and you know, he would certainly agree with Augustine on this much, because they all agreed God was a necessary being. But Aquinas had a particular way of reaching that as a conclusion to an argument that has been very influential, very potent in the history of philosophy. But again, in modern times, many people have argued about these particular proofs or five ways of Aquinas as if they were intended to answer atheism, which they most definitely were not. All right, so just a little bit there about Thomas Aquinas. Now, we've come much more than 1,000 years into church history here, but we do have a long way to go. And I'm just going to say a little bit about some other folks here to get us a little closer to the contemporary scene here, and then I'm going to open it up for some comments or questions. Again, if there's a theme to what I'm presenting here, what I'm saying here, it is that different kinds of apologetic arguments, different ways of defending Christianity or of standing up for the truth of Christianity arise in response to different sorts of challenges. And so we have the challenge of Manichaeism and Platonism being answered by Augustine. We have the challenge of Islamic philosophy being answered by Thomas Aquinas's appropriation of Aristotle in the service of a Christian philosophy. Now we're going to move forward to the Reformation era and two very different individuals. The first of these is Martin Luther. I'm sure you've all heard of Martin Luther. You might not have thought about him in connection with apologetics. It's interesting, just to draw some connections here, Luther was an Augustinian monk. That is, he was a monk in an order that regarded itself as being in the tradition of Augustine. And so you can see that there's a natural connection there, or between him and Augustine himself. And Luther is, of course, best known as the individual who lit the torch of the Reformation with his 95 Theses on October 31st, 1517. Those 95 Theses protested legalistic abuses in the church, but the Reformation ended up becoming about a lot more than that. Luther saw the fundamental problem with medieval Catholicism, which he is on the tail end, the waning hours of medieval history. He saw the fundamental problem with medieval Christianity, Western Christianity, or Catholicism, as that reason, particularly as employed in medieval theology, philosophical reasoning, had obscured the simple gospel of justification. It's important to understand that for Luther, everything pretty much revolves around justification by faith. It is the yardstick by which Luther measured everything. And Luther therefore emphasized the limitations of reason and rejected the traditional theological project of Anselm and Aquinas in particular, of using logic and philosophy to help sort of expound upon and defend the Christian faith. Luther viewed reason as an enemy, as a witch, as the devil, and had some very, very strong things to say about reason in that context. You could see how somebody in Luther's theological tradition then might come to view apologetics with some disdain, okay? Because Luther's position is, if I could put it this way, we don't need no stinking arguments, you know. and we have that in some of our Christian hymns, don't we? I need no other argument. I need no other plea. You know, it is enough that Jesus died and that He died for me. Well, that's Martin Luther. Okay, that's a very Lutheran thing to say. And so, why is he doing this? Luther is not responding to Christian apologists who are using reason to defend the existence of God against atheists. Again, it's important to keep that in mind. We've gotten so used to there being atheists as a significant intellectual force in academia and in the general culture in Western civilization for the last 100, 150, 200 years, that we forget, if we ever knew, if we studied our history, we would recognize that this is a relatively new problem. They've always been atheists, but they've generally been not very influential. Luther is not worried about atheists. Atheists are stupid, as far as he's concerned. If there are any, they're just dumb, because obviously there's a God. Luther was convinced that there was no reason to have to argue for God's existence, because it was pretty obvious to everybody. But what he was focusing on was not kind of a philosophical apologetic aimed at responding to skeptics and atheists, but he was responding to the use of philosophy in theology to try to make Christianity into a reasonable, coherent system. And Luther's complaint was they killed the gospel in the process of doing that. With all of their nice philosophical qualifications and explanations and reasonings, they had layered on layers of philosophical loopholes and explanations for things, and somehow the gospel had been lost. And so he wanted to cut through all that and say, we're going to get back to the simple gospel. The Word of God is enough for me. It's in the Word of God. The gospel is there. I'm not going to be bothered with all this this falderal of all these philosophical arguments. Now, just to jump ahead of myself here, Luther then is really the Christian thinker who sets some of the key groundwork, if I can put it that way, for the development of what we would now call fideism. And I'm going to spell that. F-I-D-E-I-S-M. Fideism is the belief that, ironically, it's a belief, the belief that our faith in Christ or in God does not rest on reason, but that we apprehend God's existence by faith alone. We apprehend God and Christ by faith alone. And you could see how Luther's emphasis on justification by faith alone could have some implications for his view of how we know that God exists, loves us, sent Christ to die for us, raised Jesus from the dead, justifies us. We know all that by faith alone. And so for Luther, fideism could be argued as a natural corollary of justification by faith. Now, I hasten to say this. Luther, arguably, was not a fideist. I am not saying Martin Luther was a fideist. What I'm saying is that the way he thought about reason and justification... Yes, we are taping this. The way that Luther thought about faith and justification and reason naturally leads to aphidism. It naturally leads that direction. And you see people later on, especially in the Lutheran tradition, adopting a aphidistic approach to things. And so I'm simply anticipating here, because we haven't really introduced the different schools of thought here. I'm just introducing some of the major players leading up to the modern time. But just to, I think this will be helpful to people, just to mention that Luther anticipates aphidism, though I would argue he was not himself a aphidist in the technical sense. Now, the other Reformation thinker that we need to mention here is John Calvin. If Luther was the father of the Reformation and its chief propagandist or polemicist, Calvin was its chief theologian. I mentioned earlier with Augustine that his City of God was one of the 10 most influential works in written works in human history, and arguably at least Western civilization and arguably human history. Calvin's Institutes of the Christian Religion also belongs in that top 10 list. His Institutes of the Christian Religion is really the preeminent work that explains the rationale for the Protestant Reformation and sets the theological tone for most of Reformation, Protestant Reformational thinking, either in agreement with Calvin or in modification or reaction against Calvin, but Calvin sets the agenda in the Institutes of the Christian Religion. Now, do I need to say this to you? If you haven't read The City of God by Augustine, if you haven't read Calvin's Institutes, you need to put that on your to-do list, okay, to read these books. And you may say, well, but I'm not a Calvinist and I don't like Calvinism. That's fine. You don't have to be a Calvinist to enjoy Calvin. I was talking with a friend of mine several years ago who was always bad-mouthing Calvinism and Calvin in particular. And I said, have you ever read Calvin's Institutes? And he had to admit that he hadn't read him. He hadn't read Calvin. All he knew was what he had heard about Calvin, either from other Calvinists or more commonly, of course, from people who were opposed to Calvinism. So I said, well, you know, you don't have to be a Calvinist if you don't want to. I'm not going to try to push that on you. But before you continue to talk more about Calvin, you might want to read him for yourself. And I would encourage you to do that. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised. So he read Calvin's Institutes and he said, you know what? I don't really have a problem with Calvin. Good Christian, loves the Lord, don't agree with everything he says necessarily, but he had a lot of respect for, much more respect for Calvin after he actually read him. And that, by the way, that happens very often. So before you criticize somebody, it'd be a good idea to get familiar with that person's thinking. And Calvin may be the most abused Christian theologian today who people have not actually read. So, and again, I'm not saying everything Calvin said was right. We all try to build on what people before us have said. We all hopefully have the gumption to disagree where we think we should disagree. But, if you can do it better than Calvin, you're doing great. Let me put it to you that way, okay? Because the guy had a lot on the ball. Now, Calvin's principal apologetic labors were directed against Roman Catholicism and the Roman Catholic criticisms of the Reformation gospel. Just as Luther was not at all concerned about atheists, neither was Calvin. He was concerned about Catholics, and specifically Catholic opposition to the Reformation movement and the Reformation theology. I should mention, though, that as with Luther, Calvin was also concerned that the Catholic theologians, in some cases at least, had been letting slip some of the theological stuffing, the theological meat of traditional Christian theology going all the way back to Augustine. I mentioned that Luther was an Augustinian monk. Well, Calvin, in his Institutes of the Christian Religion, peppers his arguments not only with biblical proof texts, but also with quotations from church fathers, mostly from Augustine. He quotes Augustine quite a bit to show that his argument is not anti-Christian or anti-Catholic in the general sense, but that in fact it has precedent in the teachings of the great Christian theologian Augustine of Hippo. So, like Luther, Calvin is focused on answering Catholic opposition to the gospel. But Calvin goes about this in a different way than Luther did. Calvin never belittled reason, never spoke ill of reason. He held that faith is always reasonable. But he also insisted that faith often seems unreasonable to us because our exercise of reason, our faculty of reason, has been distorted or blinded by sin and by spiritual deception. And that this is something we cannot overcome in ourselves, and so God has given us a revelation in Scripture that is even clearer and fuller in its revelation than anything you can get from nature. And of course, he has redeemed us through Jesus Christ and through the indwelling of the Spirit. And so, according to Calvin, reason is wonderful, but reason cannot save you. You need God's revelation, which comes with its own divine authority in Scripture that cannot be subjected to our reasonings or our tests. And again, he's saying this not to oppose efforts to convince atheists that Christianity is reasonable, but attempts to formulate Christianity in a philosophical way that ends up leaving parts of Christianity, essential parts, on the cutting room floor. All right, so that's really his focus. And that having been said, Calvin, just as Luther in a way prepares the way for or anticipates the development of fideism, Van Til anticipates or prepares the way for Reformed apologetic approaches, including presuppositionalism, as exemplified in Cornelius Van Til. And we will, of course, be talking about Van Til and other thinkers like that along the way. All I've attempted to do at this point is to give you some of the historical background to how these things develop. Now, I don't have time to go into this in detail, but I just want to kind of round out what I've said so far by saying that, as you can see, up until the time of the Reformation, Christian apologists are not dealing with atheists, they're not dealing with skeptics, generally speaking. Augustine, of course, does deal with skepticism to some extent because he lived in a pagan culture and there were skeptics. But even for him, the main focus was on responding to other forms of religious belief, Manichaeanism and Platonism as a religious philosophy, and finding Christianity to be the most credible and philosophically cogent philosophy. What you have, again, in the period of Anselm and then Aquinas and then the Reformation with Luther and Calvin, again, are Christian theologians, Christian thinkers wrestling with various apologetic questions, but not in the context of dealing with modern skepticism and modern atheism. Those kinds of questions do not arise seriously until the time of the Enlightenment. They are problems that have become serious issues in the last 200, 250 years. It is only as Christians begin to draw upon Augustine and Anselm and Aquinas and Calvin and, yes, Luther in formulating responses to atheists and deists and skeptics in the modern era that you find Christians also turning to one another and saying, hey, I don't think that's the best way of going about this. I don't think that's the best way of defending Christianity or of vindicating Christianity as true. And so that's when you start having arguments about how you should do apologetics, when you have modern atheists and skeptics and deists challenging the very foundations of Christianity that of theism, of belief in a miracle doing performing God, that's when you have the modern debate about apologetics begin to come to the surface, and it really becomes a serious argument and debate in the 20th century. All right, so that's just a kind of a quick history of apologetics up to the modern era. And in the time that we have left here, I just want to open up the floor. Maybe you've got a comment. Maybe you've got a question. If you would like to ask a question with the mic, I will be happy to yield the mic to you. If you want to type a question, that is fine as well. And if you're totally overwhelmed, I understand that too. But I wanted to give you kind of the big picture here before we start looking at these specific groups. And you know, don't be afraid to ask a question that you think is too too elementary or too simple, that because you know, we're all at different places on this, and you're probably asking something somebody else want to know. Now, there's a question about books for honors, and on the syllabus that I have provided, that I think Carrie has sent to everybody here that wanted one, and if you didn't get one, we can get you one. There is a list at the end of that syllabus of 100 books that you could choose from, and 10 of them are asterisked or are marked as being especially relevant to this course, although you're free to pick any of those 100. And if you want to do something else that I didn't list that you think really should have been listed, and run that by me, I mean, or any of us at Reclaiming the Minds, then that would be fine as well. But I've given you a pretty good list there of books that you can choose from that I think you'd get a lot out of reading any of those 100 books. Now, again, if you don't have a copy yet of Faith Has Its Reasons, I've brought up some individuals. I've mentioned Van Til. I've mentioned Fideism, although I haven't mentioned any specific individuals connected with Fideism in the modern era. That book goes into a lengthy discussion about all the various approaches to apologetics. You will find profiles in that book of the apologetic thought of people as different as C.S. Lewis, Francis Schaeffer, Gordon Clark, Cornelius Van Til, Norman Geisler, John Warwick Montgomery, William Lane Craig, C. Stephen Evans. I mean, the list goes on and on. Herman Dooyeweerd, if you've heard of him, and even if you haven't, he's in there. You'll find a lot of different approaches profiled. Edward John Carnell, David Clark, a bunch of Christian philosophers and theologians. Karl Barth. If you're not very familiar with Karl Barth, many people still would argue he was the most significant theologian of the 20th century. And you may say, gee, I'm surprised by that. Well, believe it or not, many people would say that. There is a lengthy but still digestible summary of his positions and of his church dogmatics, his magnum opus, in that book. So one of the things that you're going to get out of reading this book, besides an introduction to these different approaches to apologetics, is you'll get a really good overview of Christian history, of Christian philosophy and Christian theology, and you'll be introduced to some of the great Christian thinkers of all time, including contemporary thinkers as well as ancient, medieval, and post-Reformation thinkers. They're all in there, and I think you'll find it to be very helpful from that standpoint as well. Another thing that we do in the book that you might find interesting is that there is a, at the end of each section, the four major approaches to apologetics that are highlighted in the book, there is a sample dialogue of how somebody who takes that viewpoint might use that approach in presenting an apologetic in an actual conversation with a non-believer or with a couple of non-believers. So you'll see a dialogue of a classical apologist or an evidentialist or a presuppositionalist or even a fideist, how they would go about presenting a cogent exposition or defense of Christianity to a non-believer. So, you know, if that, in other words, there's a practical demonstration of what it might look like if you were to use that approach in the book. So that might be of interest as well, because it's concrete. Because it's one thing to talk about the theory of apologetics, but how do you actually use this? What would you say? Well, the book includes these dialogues that give you an example of what people might say who use these approaches. Well, if there are no questions, I'll go ahead and conclude our session here. And, of course, as you get into the book, if you get a chance to do that, I'm sure you're going to have a lot of questions. The plan here next week is that we are going to be talking about classical apologetics, and we're going to focus especially on C.S. Lewis. We'll probably talk about some other people as well. But we're going to be beginning our discussion of classical apologetics. We'll devote two sessions to that, and we're going to be focusing especially on chapters 4 and 5 of the book Faith Has Its Reasons. What we basically did today was chapters 1 through 3, but what we're going to be doing next week is chapters 4 and 5 of Faith Has Its Reasons. We'll talk about C.S. Lewis. We'll talk about what is classical apologetics, and so that's what we're planning to do next week. All right, listen, thanks all very much for listening, for your attention. I hope that you found this helpful. I do encourage you to come prepared for some discussion. I don't mind talking for an hour and a quarter, but I'd be happy to have as much interaction with you guys in the time that we have as we can do. So please, next week and thereafter, feel free to do that. And I look forward to that. Thanks very much.